Hey, it's Bantam, and this is the Digital Song Podcast. It's time to hack destiny. Chapter 6. Pay My Debts. Mac.
I can't believe how damn stupid you are.
Geo squeezed his hands into fists and seemed to be pushing them into his thighs, his gray goatee framing a deep frown. He gazed out the window of the Escalade EV as it rolled up Third Avenue. Mac slumped in his seat, arms crossed, as he stared at the city scene streaking by outside.
Trust me, this is not what I wanted either.
He was not concentrating on his father's diatribe. Instead, he focused on what Ezri might do to him. He had lost her product when he was arrested.
I shouldn't have gotten involved with her,
he thought. Ezri ran a criminal organization that distributed drugs, conducted ransomware attacks, and murdered its competition. She rose to prominence in the crime world by building decentralized darknet platforms like Darktasker, Cerberus, and Golden Apple, through which she sold stolen software to clandestine services abroad, laundered money, extorted politicians, and doxed celebrities. Rumors circulated that she contracted her services to terrorists and the cyber war units of foreign governments and sold stolen state secrets to the highest bidder. But these mercenary activities were not even her scariest travails. There were whispers in dark channels that she found joy in orchestrating cyber attacks on local critical infrastructure, shutting down electric grids, toxifying water supplies, and remotely commandeering container ships, all for hefty fees. Mac did not want to make her angry. When he started buying drugs from her, he never imagined that he would be swallowed up by her organization and under her control. A sudden outburst from Geo interrupted Mac's ruminations.
You gallivanting around town is costing me! Everything is at risk now!
Geo turned and looked at Mac.
How could you do this? You're facing years in prison!
He yelled, face ripening into a bright red.
And for what? You can't run a goddamn company when you're locked up. You're acting like a selfish child, doing drugs, chasing tail. You don't understand the value of money. All your success has come from the company I built.
He exhaled deeply and looked out the window again.
Now that I want to hand it off to you, you get arrested.
We already went through this. There's nothing I can do about it right now.
You better hope that Jason Sola has something up his sleeve. Getting him membership at the club is a hefty price.
Yeah, I get it.
Geo turned.
You get it? You get how disappointing it is for your son to let you down? I can't imagine what your mother would think. She had such high hopes for you. She knew how talented you are. What you could become.
The anger flared inside Mac like a hot fire in a closed cast iron stove. He turned his head to look at Geo and tried to stay calm.
I'm not you. Did you ever think that maybe I wasn't passionate about running the restaurants? There's other stuff I want to do with my life.
What else are you going to do? You didn't have the metal to finish school. Are you going to be an actor? Paint? Lord knows you're a crappy drug dealer. You got caught.
There's stuff I'm good at.
You belong in the culinary world. When you stay on track, you are good at running high-end restaurants.
It was the restaurants that got me into this mess.
There you go again, blaming everyone else around you. Take some responsibility, son. You have it made, but your skull's too thick to see it. I built Mason Restaurants so you could take the reins from me. It's our family legacy. When I started, your mother told me that she wanted you to have the family business and make something amazing out of it.
The stress of the situation and the mention of Mac's mother triggered a flood of emotional and episodic memories in his mind. Mac's relationship with Geo changed when Allegra, Mac's mother, died of an aneurysm. She had dropped dead in a cold heap next to unkneaded dough. Tendrils of hot pain and sorrow branched out in his body when he dipped into his well of memories, so he tended to leave it covered with the stony weight of indifference. When he did reach back into the vaults of reminiscence, he recalled that Allegra was a kind, loving, and expressive woman, and Geo had been a supportive and patient father who brought a jovial attitude to any situation. Mac revered them both and loved how much they were head over heels for each other. Mac remembered cooking elaborate dishes with Gio to serve to his mother, marveling at the flames leaping from the stainless steel pan as Gio deglazed it with red wine. He remembered the trips to the Catskills where they would fish and forage for fiddleheads in spring. He remembered strolls across the George Washington Bridge, from which Gio, Allegra, and Mac would admire the sunset behind the Palisades and the spotty afterglows stabbed by arcology construction sites and towers of downtown. He remembered ambling down Madison Avenue on his birthday, pointing out a flashy Breitling watch that Allegra suggested he try on. When the sales associate wrapped the bright silver band around Mac's wrist and held it up to show it off, Allegra and Gio, who were holding hands, looked at each other.
"We are getting you that handsome timepiece, my darling," Allegra said. "When you look at it, remember there is always time to bring love into the world."
Allegra's death transformed Gio. The affectionate, warm father had cooled and hardened, focusing on the restaurants rather than helping young Mac cope with the void left by his mother's death. He worked constantly at the restaurants, and while he still showed his love to Mac in many ways, he was closed off and distant most of the time.
"Why do you keep bringing Mom up? She's been fucking dead for 20 years. I don't give a shit what she thought."
He knew it was a hurtful comment, but he felt powerless. He did not actually believe the statement, but hurting Gio was the only control he could exert in the situation. Gio's head turned, mouth agape. The shocked look on his face accentuated the wrinkles that flowed from around his sockets to his eyes like they had been traced with pencil.
"I can't believe you would say that about your mother! Your words sully her memory! She loved you more than anything!"
"Maybe, but you don't seem to give a solitary shit about me and what I want."
Mac turned to watch Manhattan streak by.
"That's because you got arrested. With a brick of nose candy and a gun, you put the family legacy at risk. You're selfish."
Mac felt the vibration of his UD against his leg, so he extracted it from his pocket and looked at the screen to see a message from Esri displayed across it.
"You owe me."
Mac did not answer, distracted by Esri's message.
"How am I going to get out of Esri's grip?"
When the police seized the cocaine in Mac's Tesla, Esri lost tens of thousands of dollars or more. The loss of the cocaine, however, was not the main problem. In his panic, Mac had caused something much more valuable to vanish. The product he destroyed was sophisticated malware Esri had created. Mac was supposed to deliver it to a contact, likely some foreign spy or foreign government agent. Esri had reconfigured and partitioned the computer in Mac's Tesla to safely house and transport the specially designed malware without it being detectable by law enforcement. Esri had built in a Bluetooth-like transmission capability to allow the malware program to be transferred to the buyers when Mac pressed a button on his Tesla's console. It was genius engineering. Mac had been coached by Esri to erase the malware in the case of emergency. Esri had calmly explained to him that the self-destruct was only to be used if he was stopped by federal agents. He should play it cool during the delivery. No drugs, no weapons, no anxiety.
"Mac, the malware is virtually impossible to find,"
she had told him. No law enforcement ran checks of the processors, memory, or hard drives of Teslas after traffic stops. In rare cases, they might attempt to extract location data from the onboard computers, but without a warrant, any further technical analysis, even by police, was prohibited by Tesla's powerful terms of service. With cocaine and a pistol in the cab of the vehicle, the cops would have no reason to believe Max Tesla concealed hidden digital files. Instead of following Esri's specific instructions, Mac had brought a handgun, taken the package of cocaine Esri had given to him to sell, and headed to the malware handoff with these two conspicuously illegal items sitting on the passenger seat of his car. When the cops pulled Mac over, he had panicked and used the self-destruct button to delete Esri's specially tailored malware program. The blunder had lost Esri a payday of thousands of Ethereum valued at millions of dollars, which would have automatically passed to her secure cryptocurrency wallets when the buyers received the malware. As Gio fumed in the seat next to him and the bustling Manhattan streets passed by outside the car, Mac imagined irate Ezri, red-eyed and spitting with each word, hitting his shins with a crowbar or gouging out his eyes with a wine corkscrew.
How am I going to fix this?
Chapter 7, Superhuman, LaDonna. A caravan of shiny black cars rolled through industrial Bushwick. The procession included new-era Lincoln Frigate EVs, Bentleys with bodies curved like bullets, and petroleum-powered Rolls-Royces with angelic figureheads seemingly towing the cars behind them in flapless gliding flight. They rolled one by one into the dark complex, stopping in front of the brick warehouse with the bright ruby-red door and Pyramid Club symbol above it. The occupants, adorned in gowns, custom dresses, suits, and thick shearling coats, disembarked and strutted into the club. LaDonna Chambers was among the first guests. She stepped down from the tank-like vehicle with swagger and vanity befitting a tech trillionaire. She wore a hemp-wool sharkskin suit that seemed to glisten and shimmer around the Pyramid Club pin fastened to her lapel. Chambers approached the door, which slid open silently before her, as if triggered by motion or a mental command. Two security guards stood along the walls of the corridor inside. The first was a large man, hands crossed in front of his body, cords of sinew connecting his neck and shoulders, pushing out the fabric of his black suit jacket and black V-neck t-shirt. Across from him stood a stocky woman with muscular arms and tree-trunk legs that were rooted to the ground on the other side of the corridor.
"Welcome, M. Chambers,"
the male security guard said with a smile.
"Thank you, Thomas,"
responded Chambers. She knew security scanned all entrants for signals being emitted from active electronics, UDs, smartwatches, ear dots, or other prohibited devices. She strode down the hallway, past the guards, and through the stainless slab door, which seemed to slide open hastily as if it did not want to displease her. The Pyramid Club had financially backed incipient Arbor Systems in the mid-2020s, but it was the club's profitable investments that had exponentially increased Chambers' wealth and funded her opulent lifestyle. She had her arcology penthouse in Manhattan, a beach house in Ibiza, a yacht docked in the Hamptons, and a fleet of EVs that glided between her home, Arbor HQ offices, and the tarmac which housed the Arbor private jet. She looked around the reception hall, admiring the glass pyramid skylight above her, which allowed her to briefly see the watercolor afterglows of a New York sunset, while electro-acid jazz played from unseen speakers. She enjoyed the club events, though achieving her destiny as mother of human evolution never drifted far from her sights. She could have a drink and socialize with like-minded elites, each word of praise for Arbor and Branch making her feel like an Olympian god. She strutted to a high-top bar table, and almost immediately a server approached the table in a white double-breasted chef's coat and black pants, his clean-shaven young face broadcasting youthful exuberance and a shining smile.
"Hello, Em. Can I offer you something to drink?"
Chambers grinned back.
"Boulevardier."
The server nodded.
"I'll be right back with that for you, Em."
Chambers preferred this new ungendered title that had gained prevalence in common parlance in the past few years. She remembered being addressed as Miss or Ms. and felt that M leveled the playing field for professional women in boardrooms and executive suites because they shared titles with their male counterparts. Within a few minutes, the server returned, a stout tumbler glass in hand containing a large sphere of ice with bubble-like clarity, suspended in a light caramel-colored liquid, a lemon peel floating like a mid-autumn leaf on the liquid's surface. When Chambers received her drink, she nodded politely to the server, who bowed to her. She nursed the beverage and watched the auditorium fill with her wealthy fellow members. Chapter 8. Reckoner. Jason. Branch's alarm surged through Jason like a pulse of electricity. 1 month had elapsed since he had met the Masons and accepted their strange terms of payment. In addition to the Compass Rose dreams, the image of the red door with the pyramid and star symbol continued to infringe upon Jason's waking perceptions. The doggedness of both dreams disquieted him, but the beautiful dead woman in the Compass Rose dream disturbed him the most. When the dreams had started, Jason's stubborn attitude prevented him from even considering the possibility that the dreams were a message or fate. Now, however, through their ruthless persistence, the dreams had vanquished his obstinance, and he had started believing the woman with the tattoo existed, and his assumption that fate was a farce was eroding away. Visualizing the dead woman triggered Jason's lingering regret for not being with Anton when the cops killed him. Now, he had developed a strong connection to the woman in the dream, and he felt the urge to intervene, however he could, to prevent the horrible death that awaited her.
I'm eager to see how the Mason's payment ties into these dreams.
Usually, Jason was kempt and clean-shaven, but in the month since his meeting with Mac and Geo Mason, a stubbly beard had formed on his jaw. His puffy eyes betrayed his substantial anti-aging skincare routine, and his abnormal sleep patterns caused his eyes to narrow into slits. His distracted and inattentive behavior started interfering with his life. After weeks of sporadic communication, Alyssa severed her connection with him.
I need more,
she had told him.
I want to feel wanted.
But Jason could barely focus on Alyssa because every thought was overshadowed by the dream imagery.
No, don't let it overwhelm you,
he thought, laying in his bed. To root himself in reality, Jason focused on his work on Mac's case from the past month. During Mac's arraignment, his first court appearance, Jason skimmed the allegations, getting the gist of what the prosecutors and police had charged. At that time, Jason understood the charges to be possession of cocaine, ostensibly for personal use, failure to obey a traffic control device, in this case, running a red light, failure to use a turn signal, and most substantially, possession of an illegal plastic ghost gun made with a 3D printer. He re-examined the complaint with Mac after their discussion of payment at the first meeting in his office. He read the charges to Mac from his slate device. On October 14th, 2039, at approximately 2 o'clock in the morning, the defendant did, knowingly and unlawfully, possess a controlled substance, to wit, three small glassine baggies each containing approximately 3 grams of a white powdery substance, 1 gram per baggie, found pursuant to a lawful traffic stop for failure to obey a traffic control device when defendant failed to stop at a red traffic signal and turned left from eastbound 11th Street onto northbound 2nd Avenue, failing to activate his left turn signal, all occurring in Manhattan, City of New York, County of New York. The substance, found in the glove compartment of defendant's gray Tesla Model Z two-door coupe, tested positive for the presence of cocaine after officers used a Scott's reagent field test. See attached field test supporting deposition. The defendant did also possess a loaded firearm, to wit. Officers found a plastic, 3D printed handgun, which the defendant did possess under the driver's seat in plain view, with the defendant occupying the driver's seat during the traffic stop, with no other passengers in the car. The magazine contained 17 bullets, with one loaded in the chamber.
The charges are bullshit,
Mac exclaimed.
I made a perfect stop at the red light, I swear. I didn't turn until it was green. I had a gun and drugs in the car. Why the hell would I put myself at risk by doing something stupid like that?
People had a natural tendency to remember things with a bias in favor of themselves,
Jason thought, but in this instance, he knew Mac was correct.
I know you were paying attention.
How's that?
As if choreographed, D-Rock walked in.
We have some convincing footage of you.
D-Rock was an ex-semi-pro basketballer turned cyber analyst who towered over most in the city at 6'3". Behind D-Rock's dreads, large diamond studs twinkled against her earlobes. Her eyes glinted beneath her visies, which looked like nerdy librarian glasses that Jason thought she wore purposefully to make herself more approachable when she interviewed witnesses and clients. She recounted to Jason that she felt people were intimidated by her, and concluded the last thing the defense team needed was witnesses to complain to the prosecutor that a tall black woman had been menacing or coercive when asking them to speak with her. Beyond great interpersonal investigative skills, D-Rock was a trained computer engineer heavily involved in the open-source software community. She could read code, write scripts, and extract facts from any digital device, which were all critical skills when Jason built strategies for his clients.
Mac, this is D-Rock, our investigator and absolute cyber guru.
Nice to meet you, Mac.
You too.
Jason gestured to D-Rock to sit down, passed her the slate device, then rolled his chair closer to Mac so they could all see the display.
Immediately after we met, I ran a program Anton developed that uses fancy data analytics and AI. It connects to the big socials via API. It scans all posts in a given time frame to find relevant info.
Jason tried not to wince when he mentioned his dead friend.
The bottom line is I found a post from the time and location of the traffic stop.
Jason tilted the slate device so Mac could see the screen. The short video from the story of a public Instagram account with the handle Jenny Marie's Big Heart showed a young woman laughing with her friends as Mac's Tesla drove up 2nd Avenue in the background. Superimposed over the video in colorful text were hashtag Pizzazz Restaurant and hashtag Sally's on 2nd.
You can't even see my car turn the corner.
True, but that's not all,
D-Rock said.
Right after finding this post, Jason and I walked to the corner of 11th and 2nd where your traffic infractions had allegedly occurred. In the age of technology, a recording device like a security camera for a retail establishment or residence often captures helpful footage or at least gives some context to the incident. These kinds of recordings are typically overwritten within 48 hours. Small retailers don't use cloud networks to store endless camera footage, so they need a reason to retain video on their networks.
Did you find something?
We found gold,
Jason said. As Jason swiped through screens on his slate device to bring up the footage, he described how he stood at the intersection of 11th and 2nd and looked around and saw Sally's, the bar referenced in the post he found, which had two security cameras facing the intersection.
The manager at Sally's gave me footage of the evening without much arm twisting. I offered to pay him. He preferred crypto, so I sent him 0.001 Ether, worth about $65. He went into his office, digitally clipped the footage, and airdropped it to D-Rock's UD. We all shook hands, and I came back here with D-Rock.
Mac nodded, eyebrows furrowed. Jason hit play on the screen. The camera's point of view captured the intersection clearly in the background.
This is really good,
Jason said.
The video shows that you observed all traffic laws perfectly. You used your turn signal, stopped when the light was yellow behind the crosswalk, and waited through the light before finally turning left. Like it's from a driver's ed textbook.
Mac's lips turned upward slightly in an expression of vindication as he watched. Laying in bed, Jason felt encumbered, as if a weighted vest were draped on his chest, but he managed to pull himself up to a seated position. As if someone had pressed a button, the compass rose popped into his head.
I am losing my ability to distinguish real from imaginary.
Even in a state of mental and physical exhaustion brought on by the dreams relentlessly invading his consciousness, Jason had appeared with Mac in open court 2 weeks prior, around Halloween. Jason accompanied Mac to the dais when Mac's case was called up by the courtroom deputy, and Jason proffered a vague description of the story from Mac's perspective. Jason posited that the police fabricated the facts behind the traffic infractions, meaning that in actuality, what had occurred was an illegal search and seizure. His argument received an audible scoff, then a counter-argument from the prosecutor, Tyler Brodson. Jason had demanded a hearing in which the prosecutor would have to prove that the search and seizure of the car, drugs, and gun were justified. The court had granted Jason's motion and scheduled the hearing. Jason knew it would be his opportunity to forcefully press the boot heel of Mac's defense into the neck of the prosecution's case. Sliding off the side of his bed lethargically, Jason began his daily routine, unlocking Branch and thinking commands to turn on the shower, start the coffee, raise the blinds.
It's Friday, it's November.
It was all he could remember about the present in his mental haze. Next thing Jason knew, he was sitting at his desk in his office.
How'd I get here?
He thought.
I don't remember my commute, I only remember the compass rose.
He shook his head vigorously.
These dreams cannot distract me from my life.
Jason slapped himself in the face, once on each cheek with each hand.
I can focus on my work.
Just then, D-Rock's physique filled Jason's office doorframe. She was visibly excited, big smile propping up her cheeks.
I found some good shit on Arbor. You got a few minutes to chat?
Not trying to brush you off, but I need to focus on Mac Mason's case right now.
Well, you'll be pretty amped with what I have to tell you. It's sensitive. A few days before his death, Darden reached out to a journalist to say that she may have a scoop that would change the future of Arbor.
Jason rubbed his chin.
I wonder what she was talking about.
I'm supposed to meet her in the next few weeks. I'll keep you posted.
Who's the journalist?
They wouldn't give me their name. Seemed pretty scared.
Yikes. Sounds like you're onto something serious. Keep chasing. Let's catch up after you meet them.
Will do.
D-Rock turned, then sprung back into the doorway to face Jason.
Oh yeah, almost forgot. A gift for the Mason case.
She tossed an object at Jason, who caught it after bobbling it. It was a USB stick.
You're welcome.
D-Rock grinned, then left. Returning his gaze to his tile screen, Jason pushed the USB stick into the side of his computer, and a file instantly appeared. It was disciplinary records written by NYPD Internal Affairs about the officer who pulled Mac over. Jason perused the documents in the file and found an adjudication of the officer, suspending him for 2 weeks without pay for lying in sworn affidavits in several other cases.
Got you, you corrupt piece of shit.
Jason began constructing his strategy for Mac's hearing, integrating the persuasive new evidence. As soon as he started his legal work, the nagging dreams faded to a dull hum in the background of his consciousness, and his productivity skyrocketed. He planned to devote the whole day into weaving a powerful defense for Mac. By the ninth hour, Jason had organized a detailed strategy flowchart, created a checklist of crucial facts that he needed to elicit during the hearing, and drafted an aggressive cross-examination of the expected witnesses made more robust by feeding his ideas into open-source AI large language models like ChatGPT and Claude. Work myopia, as it turned out, was his only effective method for counteracting his fixation on the dreams. When he toggled off the lights and walked out of the co-op office, however, the images came flooding back. The urge to self-medicate with alcohol and drugs prodded him, so instead of turning toward his condo, he plodded through the narrow streets of the Lower East Side, seeking a place to pour bourbon down his gullet to dull the intensity of the parasitic dreams. Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.